You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, we're going to step way outside the box with my guest, Nancy DeVille. Nancy is an author and women's rights advocate who has led a very unconventional life. After graduating high school in Japan, where she lived as a Navy brat, Nancy hitchhiked across India and worked and traveled in Spain and Switzerland. She spent 15 years as a successful fashion designer. Then she wrote and co-authored influential books on food and health. Her new novel, Karma, is based upon her 2 decades of research into the global sex trade. It's a tough topic, but Karma is a story of courage, hope, and spirituality. To learn more, visit her public website at www.nancydeville.com, and we'll repeat that again at the end of the show. So let's welcome Nancy to the show now and find out more. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
I'm great, Lance. How are you?
I'm good. When I try to read every author's book that is sent to me because, you know, that's just the way it is. If you want to do a good job, you want to read their works. And I just want to tell everybody that when I started your book, it was so disturbing in the beginning that I had to put it down, and I thought, I'm not sure that I can read this. And then I thought, now listen, Lance, you've lived through things much worse than this.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to, go ahead and read it and see what happens, because I felt like it was catching me. Well, a few sentences later, I was hooked. And I'm telling you, this book is a mind blower. It is beautifully written. It's one of the best novels of any subject that I've read in a long time. And the descriptions and the characters just pop out at you. And you kind of forget, to some extent, the horrors that are going on. But you live them. You go through everything that the main character goes through. And it's an eye-opening book, and it's an important book. So I just want to tell you that everybody should just go out and buy it and read it and find out, because it really is loosely, thinly veiled fiction, isn't it, Nancy?
Yes, it's really just one story of the millions of stories that are happening to women and children across the globe today. And I made my protagonist American just simply because I wanted people to really have, no cultural barrier between what's happening,
mm-hmm.
and, I wanted people to really feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I did a good job because I'm getting a lot of comments like yours. And it is really disturbing, but I think we really need to know about this.
Well, yes, and that's kind of part of the process of healing our shadow. For so many thousands of years, we've pretty much stuffed all our dirty laundry down, and it has to come up somehow. And so what we find is it erupts in strange and bizarre ways. Jeffrey Dahmer and people like that. But a healthy person is able to look at these situations and see themselves in them, and then figure out what can be done. Because this does go on quite a bit, doesn't it?
Well, the estimates are 2 to 4 million women and children across the globe. That's a lot of people. And, of course, those numbers are always changing because, people die and new sex slaves are recruited.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to say exactly how many people are affected,
mm-hmm.
but it's millions.
Oh yeah. Out of curiosity, what inspired you to write the book on the topic of sexual slavery?
You know, Lance, that nothing really. I mean, I really didn't know what I was getting into, honestly. I just, like you said, I had a long career in the film industry and design, and I decided that I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to change careers, and I thought, well, I need a topic, and I had been a hippie hitchhiker in 1968 and 69. I traveled overland from Europe to India, and all of the hippies stopped at a restaurant called the Pudding Shop in Istanbul.
Oh.
Have you been there?
No, this is fascinating, because I was a hippie too, but I never made it that far.
So it was really called Lael's Restaurant, but everybody called it the Pudding Shop. And it was where you went to, you know, find out how much backsheesh you had to pay to get whatever you needed and just, you know, just hang out and be cool. And everybody went there on their way to India and Kathmandu and on the way back. And so while I was there eating my pudding, I met a girl who told me that I should be careful for white slavers. And I thought, oh, you know, wow. And, of course, I wasn't, because I was 18 years old and I was extremely babyish. 18 years old. But years later, when I wanted to change careers and be a novelist, I thought that would be a great subject. So I really didn't know what I was getting myself into, honestly. So it was only after I got into it that I realized how profound it was.
It's going on in just about every country, isn't it? Including the United States.
Yes, including the United States.
Yes. I've even heard rumors on the internet that it's quite a big business, that the mafia is involved and some governments are involved, and politicians and wealthy people, and it's quite a lucrative operation.
Well, if you just take a rough estimate, let's call it 2.5 million women and children who are forced to service 20 customers a day, that's 50 million transactions every single day times 365 days a year. So that's a lot of money, no matter what country you're in. And so it is organized crime, but it's also thugs. You know, it's just your basic common criminal, because why should they traffic in drugs and risk incarceration and be dodging bullets and endangering their own lives when they can traffic in women and children without any risk to themselves?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then women and children are much easier to transport across borders, much safer for the sex slavers. And there's an endless supply of replacements. They can be sold over and over again, whereas if you sell a drug, you know, you sell it one time, right?
Right.
And then they're easy to dispose of when they're no longer of value. So now sex trafficking is the third largest criminal industry under drugs and gun running. But it's closing in. And so now, finally, it's getting a little bit of attention. And so when I hear that people say, I don't want to read it, I don't want to know about it, my feeling, because I've read so much about it, is you have to, because it makes you uncomfortable, you need to look at it. Because it's happening to people right now. While we're sitting here in our comfortable environments, somebody is being subjected to systematic rape, forced drug addiction, and torture.
Yes. Now, you show an example of how the main character, Dr. Meredith Fitzgerald, was taken, and it was, you know, just kind of an innocent little side trip down one of the bazaars, and the taxi driver was helping her, and she drank something and then she was asleep. Can you give us a little teaser of what happened to her when she woke up?
Well, what happens to all the women is exactly the same. It's the process of seasoning. And so it's rape, forced drug addiction, isolation, torture. They do what they have to do to break people's will so that they're too afraid to run away or to say anything. And, you know, I have people all the time when I do my book talks who come up to me and they tell me stories. And one woman told me that she goes to Dubai a lot for business and that she sees girls all the time. Everybody knows why they're huddling in the airport. Everybody knows who they are, what's happening to them.
Oh.
And it's just the way it is.
Yes.
So these girls are too afraid they can be in a public place, but they're not going to try to run away. And so that's why, you know, one of the things that I would like to bring to light in our country, you know, let's say you're driving down the street, you see a girl, you know, in spike heels and a mini skirt and a lot of makeup, and she's leaning into a car, and, you know, even though it doesn't give you a warm and fuzzy feeling, the fact is she's not there because she wants to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that I've learned about sex trafficking, the more I realize that there really isn't a line between what we call prostitution or hooking or whatever and sex slavery. It's the same.
Yep. Now, one of the things that's so disturbing about these other countries is that these countries are so old, and they, you know, we're accustomed to a certain kind of refined form of this in our own cities. You know, we can easily say, oh, they're just the pretty girls on the corner. But these girls can be taken anywhere, and they're, you know, from teenagers or younger to the beautiful, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, although I'm guessing they probably don't take girls usually that are older. But they're all beautiful girls, and then there's a process of hurting and breaking them down, which I thought was really interesting, that it's pretty consistent that one person, one girl, will resist more than the others. And so they always have a method to get the rest in line by pouring various, liquids into their eyes and ears and nose, and they just literally dissolve. And so the poor girl's laying there with, you know, no face practically. And so the other girls, for having resisted so strongly, and the other girls are just terrified, and they've all been beaten and raped and, you know, have injuries and the rest of it. And then they fall into line, and somebody cleans them up and gets them ready for sale. And by that time, they're not even thinking about escape.
No, they're too afraid. They're too afraid, and they're deeply traumatized. And and then if you imagine what it would be like for a child to be sold by his or her parents. And then to be systematically raped and to grow up, to go through adolescence that way. It's been going on for a long time. This is nothing new. The only new thing is that now people are starting to become aware of it, and people are starting to crusade a little bit. But there's so much money that's necessary, because once the kids or the young women are rescued, they have to be rehabilitated. And that takes a long time and a lot of patience, a lot of love and compassion, and, you know, they have to be repatriated back to their homes and sometimes their homeland, or they need to find a new place for them to live. Sometimes they have children, and they have to take their babies someplace. So it's a huge, huge problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, of course, the people who do this are running under the wire with authorities, and they have planes, and they have some of them have quite luxurious houses. But the girls themselves are usually kept in some kind of dungeon that's down
mm-hmm.
below in a subterranean vault or something, and they're just all mushed together, and they're just herded around like cattle.
Right. So the women and children do not live in luxury by any stretch of the imagination.
Uh-huh.
They live in terrible circumstances, filthy, terrible circumstances with bad food, bad everything. So they're just there until they are no longer useful, and then
mm-hmm.
they're discarded.
And
a lot of them contract HIV,
yeah,
and
yeah.
they don't have, obviously they're not taking, they're not going to take care of them at that point. So
right, right. It's a really sad and very poignant situation. And, you know, it's just, it's another thing that we have to be aware of, and not only just for, you know, people who have kids that are traveling over there, but just, you know, what can we do about
mm-hmm.
something that is just like a global, international operation that makes billions and trillions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we're now seeing so many different aspects of our dark side, you know, the Wall Street manipulations and the corruption and greed and lies and manipulation there, and that's, in a sense, that's no different because we're all the ones getting raped.
It really does beg the question, and I've pondered this for so many years, Lance, like, who are these customers? It really does boggle the mind that if there are this many women, if those 50 million customers every day, who are they? How can they live with themselves? And I think in many cases, they really don't understand what they're doing. And so, like, let's just take, for example, Italy. Because Italy gets girls trafficked from Eastern Europe and these really impoverished countries. And so the girls answer ads for housekeepers and nannies and waitresses and things like that.
Uh-huh.
They really do think that they're going to be able to send money home to their parents, or
uh-huh.
maybe they're a single mother and they have a baby or something,
uh-huh.
and they end up being trafficked. So there's such a glut of streetwalkers now in Florence and Rome and Milan, and that it's just like going to have a cappuccino. It's just nothing.
Wow.
And so now that we're talking steps away from the Vatican, basically. And so if there was a major educational campaign, I believe that a great majority, not all, but a lot of these men would stop doing it if they knew they were raping women.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's socially acceptable and the girl has a big smile on her face,
mm-hmm.
she's inviting, then a lot of men don't know because they're not thinking with the one big brain, they're thinking with the smaller brain, you know? And
right,
so we need to have that education, and that's where government could really, really step in and do some good.
Well, gee, you know, I agree with you totally, and, you know, you have people crying out that government's too big, and it's cutting back education and art and English and so on and so forth. It just seems like such an uphill battle to do the right thing and to have agencies that are not corrupt and are not being paid off and
mm-hmm.
bought off, because that seems to be pretty much the status quo everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
Those agencies that are here to protect the people with food and health, I think you should know this because you've written some bestsellers on health subjects.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, our health is just going down the tubes.
Right.
You know?
Lance, you and I could go off on a major tangent on that one.
Oh, we could. We could. We'll save that for another show. Because this is really important.
So getting back to education, though, now we have a huge problem at truck stops with these girls who are trafficked. And some of them are like, I want to say 11, 12, 13 years old. They call them lot lizards. And so the truckers now in this country talk about banding together, are really banding together to try to stop this from happening. Mm. And so I think that's really great, and we need more education about that, because it's logical that girls would end up in places like that. And and so that's just one example of education. Once the truckers realized that these girls don't want to be there, which they should have realized anyway, they're having sex with children, but then they started rebelling against it, and they started trying to help the girls. So there's a lot to be done there, but the awareness is growing, and that's great. And that's what I'm talking about with education. You know, let's just at least get the word out. If people become aware and educated and know what's happening, and you know, I wrote a book with the theme of sex trafficking, but human trafficking, slavery, is a huge, huge problem in the world. And there are slaves everywhere in this country. If you walk down the street, there's probably a slave in a restaurant, in a dry cleaning establishment, in somebody's home cleaning their house. There are slaves everywhere. And we all know that there are slaves picking our strawberries and our tomatoes and things like that, right? I mean, that's no big secret. So trafficking, human trafficking, human slavery is a huge problem in the world. Like, I want to say something like 27 million people. It's a huge number.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was larger than that. It really wouldn't. And now another aspect of this is, you didn't get into this in your book, and I just want to mention this as a sideline so people are aware of it, but there are a lot of people are being sold for body parts.
Right.
That's a huge industry as well for the wealthy who need a, you know, a lung or a heart or an eye or something like that. And
well, I did touch on it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
In the book?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe that's why I got the idea. I was so absorbed in it. I just drank it in. Especially, my goodness, your descriptions of India and the trek. It has so many wonderful mythic and metaphoric qualities to it. And the degradation of the river, and there's just a feeling of squalor, and just things have not... They've just descended into the lowest, high spiritual place has kind of, it's still going on, but it's just gone down to the lowest common denominator. And you capture these feelings so beautifully.
Thank you.
And especially of the main character and the changes she goes through.
Thanks.
My goodness.
And, yeah, I lived her experience. I really
Oh, my God. You must have, because you just fall in love with her. You know, you just feel for her, and she's such a wonderful person, and yet you feel her everything she goes through, all of the changes, and you know, she tries to help, and she tries to do this, and it's just, you know, it's so much of it is futile, and she's an investigator. She's almost like a little Sherlock Holmes, because she finds out more about her abductors, and they are fascinating characters.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. The woman.
Mrs. I had a good time with her. She was a psycho. She was a very interesting person. And, you know, my agent read one of the very last drafts, and he said, well, I really love it, but, you know, the best villains are the ones like Tolstoy created, where you end up sort of sympathizing with them. So that's when I went back, and we're not gonna do any spoilers, but that's when I went back and made Mrs. Pawar a little bit deeper so you could really understand how she became the person that she was. Not that I'm excusing anybody's behavior, but it is a book, and it is right. It is meant in part to be entertainment as
right.
a psychological
and it
thriller.
Is.
So
it is.
So Mrs. Poore really sort of, once I got into her parlor and started looking around, I really got her, and she became a lot more of a deep character, and we began to understand her mental illness a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So she was actually, even though she was really twisted, she was a lot of fun to write, actually.
Oh, I'll bet. She's just got so many facets to her. I mean, she was a wonderful character, and you did a masterful job of doing what your agent suggested. Because, like I said, you don't want to spoil the show. You want people to read this, but it's worth reading just for the characters alone. I mean, have you been approached to make it into a movie yet?
I have had a lot of calls. Making adult dramas right now is really, really difficult. If you just go, if you scroll through demand, it's just astonishing how many thousands of films there are, hundreds
right.
of films, rather, that
right.
are geared towards, you know, 14-year-old boys. So that's really where the money right. is in the film industry right now. But I've gotten a lot of calls, and a lot of people have expressed interest, and they certainly have loved the book. So, you know, it's really the beginning of the game. So it's taken me a long time to finish the book and get it launched and everything. So I should just go back a little bit and explain a little bit about the history of the book, because that was interesting too. When I started it in 1990, I spent 2 years writing it, and then I had a plan, Lance. I thought, well, I bought a book called How to Get an Agent or something like that.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I'll send out query letters to 10 agents, and I'll get those rejections. And then I'll send out to another 10, and I'll get those rejections. But as it turned out, I got an agent in the first batch that went out. And, and she was in the same agency as John Grisham at the time. So I was really excited. I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have a bestseller and everything. But it didn't sell. And you can imagine, in 1992... the reaction I got to, even though the story was really different and it was very immature, comparatively speaking, one editor said that my protagonist was stupid for having gotten herself abducted. The abduction part was relatively the same in the earlier draft. And another one said I should have written a harem book. And they just they didn't even really believe that sex trafficking occurred. So then I spent 13 years writing in the health and wellness genre, which you mentioned, and I really love that field because I'm over the top nutcase about health. And in fact, my fan Facebook page, is still devoted to that. I do videos every day of me talking about various things, everything from quitting smoking to exercising to weight loss to just you name it. And so I really love that field. I loved it. I had a really good time in it. But then I really wanted to be a novelist for the duration. And so that's why I resurrected Karma and rewrote it and launched it. So that's just the history. I mean, I didn't spend exactly 20 years researching, but over that 20-year period, I read books. I became a lot more educated. And also during that period of time, whereas there was really nothing written in 1990, now there's a lot.
Mm.
And a lot of organizations devoted to helping sex slaves, to helping eradicate slavery. So it's gone from just virtually obscurity to being really in the public eye.
Well, you know, I guess you can say, you can give yourself some credit for being part of that movement, for sure.
Thank you. I want to be. I mean, I think that it's every writer's duty to write one book of social significance. And I've really loved helping people with their health and In fact, on my fan Facebook page, I answer any question that anybody gives me by doing a video, and it's a lot of fun. And I love that, but this is really important to me, and I'd like to be just the smallest little spark of awareness, because this is a crime against humanity, just like any Holocaust, any genocide. This is a really, really deep, deep problem, and people need to, we just can't turn away from it. We have to, I think that if we all turn toward it, that would be a really good step. Do you know?
Absolutely. Well, that's a process of shedding light on it. And there's an interesting kind of a spiritual thread through this as well. The name of the book is Karma. So, and of course, it takes place in countries such as India and where, you know, the Hindu religions are practiced. And can you share a little bit about the title and some of the spiritual aspects of the book?
Yeah, it was a process of my pondering and my development of my own education along the years that I wrote the drafts, and I became really deeply involved with my character, Meredith Fitzgerald. But the very, very first thing that happened to me, Lance, was and this was before Google, believe it or not. I mean, it's so hard to imagine a time when we had to go to the library to do our research, but you know that old saying, write what you know. Well, I don't know anything, so... I always have to research everything I do.
Right, me too.
And so I stack up piles of books, and I read piles of books on every subject that I write about. And so I went to the library to look under white slavery in the Dewey Decimal System. Remember that? And that I couldn't find anything, so I asked the librarian, and she brought out the Library of Congress book. And so it was referenced under prostitution. And both of us were really speechless, and it was just so shocking to me, because I knew even back then that we were talking about systematic rape, forced drug addiction, and torture. And here these poor people were being categorized as prostitutes, and everybody knows they're the scum of the earth, right? And so that was a real shock to me. I thought, how unfair and how awful. And then, as I learned more, I understood that they all suffer from post-traumatic stress. And I learned this because I was, like you said, I'm really involved in trying to make my character believable. And so I had to live her experience, and she was traumatized and blaming herself, because that's part of post-traumatic stress. Okay, so that's two strikes. And then in many countries of the world, especially India, where my story takes place, sex slaves are often condemned, more often than not. And the basis is the fact that people believe they brought it on themselves because it was their karma. And I thought, that just didn't sound right to me, even though my character is living that. And she's, you know, she's got the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu Bible. It's the only possession she's allowed to keep. And then she has Mrs. Poor, who we mentioned earlier, the demented woman who, with her own really demented spiritual views, talking to her about karma. And then Mrs. Poor's brother, Mr. Shantaram. So he's really twisted, and he's got his own views, twisted views on karma. And so I thought, I really wanted to explore this from all angles. And what I ultimately learned, because I am a researcher, and if Meredith was reading the Bhagavad Gita, I had to read it too, so I read it. And then I did some more exploration, and what I found was that, and I'm making this really simplistic because I am not a Hindu scholar, okay?
Right.
But just that... karma, as it's interpreted by the Bhagavad Gita, does not mean cause and effect, necessarily. It's not that you did something bad and something bad's going to happen to you. Because look at, don't we all know really despicable people and their lives are going really, really well? And we know saints, right? I mean, just incredible people that every time you turn around, you're hearing something that bad that happened to them. really tragic, right?
Right.
So how could that even make sense? And does a 5-year-old deserve to be raped, or does that Eastern European girl that's being turned out in the street in Florence because she wanted to feed her baby, did she deserve it? So karma really just defines the world at large. So if you try to be good, you try to do good things and contribute, you're contributing to the good karma of the world. If you're a bad person, you're contributing bad karma to the world, but it's not necessarily going to come back at you. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to have that as my overarching message because I care so much. I cared so much from that first 15 minutes of research about women being blamed and women being further victimized by society that I wanted to have that be the message of the book, that they weren't to blame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah, I got that message loud and clear, and I agree with that. I agree with that. What are the three ways that women and children are trapped in sexual trafficking?
Okay, so in our country, it's generally coercion. So that means somebody will swoop down at a bus stop or on the internet and tell a girl she's beautiful and I can take care of you and I care about you, I can provide security, nobody's ever cared for you like I care for you. Mm-hmm. Or it can be an offer for modeling, dancing, acting, that kind of thing. And in the case of these Eastern European girls, waitresses, nannies, housekeepers. And also
right.
That happens in other countries too, like Philippines and Indonesia, where they think they're going to go to Saudi Arabia or other Middle Eastern countries to be housekeepers, and they're really going for both, right?
Right, right.
So that's coercion. And then there's kidnapping, just plain out abduction, which my main character, so I have three characters in the book, and they all represent one of these things. So Camille, the other American girl.
Oh, I loved her.
thank you. Yes, she really, she was too big for a while. I had to tone her down a little bit.
She's almost borderline now, but I loved her anyway.
So Camille is an example of coercion. So she answered an ad to be a dancer in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Okay, and so she flew to Japan with her babysitting money. Meredith was abducted, and then Serena, the little girl, is sold by her parents. So that happens a lot in impoverished countries, and you hear stories now and then in the United States, and I'm sure it happens a lot more than we know it's happening, where, you know, the boyfriend takes the girl or the mother takes the girl and sells her for sex, girl or boy. So those are the three methods, coercion, kidnapping, and buying children from their parents.
Well, and of course, once that happens, there's really no going back. Once those wheels are in motion, it's pretty final. Unless somehow, do the girls ever break away? I mean, they're kept in a state of being high on usually heroin and some other drugs to keep them docile.
Mm-hmm.
And so they develop a horrible addiction to heroin. And so there's one of the chains that holds them there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, another would be the fear that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
When a whole group of girls is picked up, and then one of them is always going to be the one that resists more than the rest, and they use her as an example by cutting ears off or poking her eyes out or, you know, acid on the face, whatever it is that they do that, you know, destroys her, and then she's just laying there dying.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of them all kind of fall into lockstep.
Wouldn't anybody...
Oh, my God, yes. That's what's so scary about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I felt like I was in there, and it was just, my goodness. Your book is so well written, I just can't say that enough.
Thank you.
You just have to, you know, be determined to know that there is a journey there, and don't get put off by the subject matter in the first, chapter or the first few pages. Because like you, I just said to myself, well, this has something that is valuable for me, and I don't know what it is yet, but I need to look at this. And so I forced myself to get through that one little moment, and then from then on, I could not put it down. It's riveting.
Thank you.
It really is.
I hear that a lot. It's really great. As an author, you want to hear that, but I can never hear it enough.
Oh, I know, absolutely. So, and you're giving me some ideas for me writing my next book.
Oh, good.
About how to approach it, because, like you said, the hard part is, well, I want to write something that makes a difference, but what?
Mm-hmm.
And, lots of ideas come up, but I like the way you selected this, and you did your research, and you brought into light something that was just stunning in its character. It's totally character-driven. And the images from the places that you take the girls to and the trafficking to are just so vivid that you they're unforgettable. They really
Thank
are.
You.
And
Thanks.
I read a lot of books, so they aren't all like that.
Thank you. Well, I had it, of course, vetted by a number of experts. One was a doctor. She was a psychiatrist, because I wanted to make sure that was right. And then I also had an Indian friend read it. And so I did my research, and then I had it vetted very, very carefully. I wanted to have things accurate.
Yes, because even though it is a work of fiction, it's so close and so thinly veiled that you just can't escape the truth of it. I mean, it just stares you in the face. But I just love the characters, and I just can't say enough good things about the book. I'm telling you, it's a must read.
Thank you. I do want to point out too, Lance, that it's not just India and Turkey, and I just used those places because
right.
I traveled extensively there, and I knew that I could get the settings right and the characters right. But it's every country of the world.
Right.
So,
right.
And I do actually have that disclaimer in my book, because I don't want to be pointing fingers at any country.
Right.
I'm pointing fingers at the entire globe. Shame on us. For letting
right. And here it is, the 20th century, and we're supposed to be, nearing the dawn of a golden age, according to many who claim that, we're moving into some new phase of evolution. But we can't be bringing this old garbage into a new paradigm. I just don't see how it could possibly, it just doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
All of that horrible behavior and corruption and violence against human beings, it's just so prevalent. And then, you could easily write a book about the suburbs and what goes on with parents and uncles and babysitters and this and that. I mean, the suburbs are a hotbed of incest and rape and abuse, and it's just, we don't see it, and we don't want to see it, so we wait for the news to come on and find out about so-and-so was killed for, having raped his kids, and they grabbed the shotgun and blew him away.
Mm-hmm. Well, the experts say that that buying a woman, buying a prostitute, is an act of violence against women. And if you look at it like that, then you start looking at these 50 million transactions a day, probably plus, as acts of violence, acts of anger against women, and you think, why are men so angry with women? Maybe we need to look at that. What about our global culture has made men so angry with women? And I think that's something that's a very interesting question and something
that
we need to look at.
That is an interesting question. You know, you could easily make an argument that the man has dominated for many hundreds, if not thousands, of years, all the way back to the stories of the beginning of Adam and Eve, and has written out the divine feminine and the mysteries that, you know, included the intuitive side and the psychic side and the love and the compassion. And so, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Vatican and the girls all hanging out around the Vatican. And then you just walk inside and you've got, you know, pedophilia going on rampantly at the top, at the very highest echelons of that. So nobody's blameless, you know, and it just seems odd that those who seem to be the purest and speaking the loudest are often the ones that are the most guilty of doing these things.
Yeah. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? And I think that just becoming educated, understanding what's happening, and the next time you walk past a streetwalker, I don't care how used up she looks, that you know, have compassion in your heart.
Oh, yes.
That would be the absolutely, absolutely least you could do.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And the same with the alcoholic in the street that's, you know, or the drug addict that's asking for spare change. You know, that for all intents and purposes, that could be us sitting there.
I know.
You know.
Well, I am a student of Buddhist metta meditation. And metta is loving kindness meditation. And so what you do is you basically repeat four phrases. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live my life with ease. And so when I pass somebody who looks really down and out, I repeat those phrases. May she be safe, may she be happy, may she be healthy, may she live her life with ease. And it's just a vibe, you know, you just want to, for lack of a better word, just give some compassion. Just feel some compassion. And it's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that the female side of the equation is much more in touch with that on a personal level, because not only is there that direct connection with birth and a spirit coming through, but there's the intuitive, empathic, feeling and compassionate side, which many men are working to develop. But for the most part, in this type A personality society we have, they've shut that down, because that would require having a conscience and not doing the things that they do, which are out of integrity.
On the other hand, I was really pleasantly surprised to see how many men are very involved in stopping sex trafficking, and men who have given up their lives and their careers, lucrative careers, to devote themselves to their, you know, to establish organizations and to lobby in Congress and things like that. So it's there are a lot of heroes out there. Amazing, amazing people who are working very hard behind the scenes.
Well, now, that brings up the question, what can the average person do to help combat these problems?
Well, obviously, beyond just revising your own feelings about the common prostitute on the street and people who you may run into, so that you feel compassion rather than disdain or judgment, which, by the way, that's a normal psychological response. When you feel squeamish, when people feel squeamish, is to push away with judgment. And so it's a good thing just to check yourself. Okay, I got it. I'm aware. I get it. I felt that way. You know, now I want to feel a different way. I'm going to override that.
Good, good. I like that.
So, what does it hurt you? What does it hurt you just to feel some compassion? It's free, you know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
The other thing is that these organizations really need money. And even if you just sent them $5, if everybody sent $1, $5, whatever you can
mm-hmm.
afford, most of them operate on a shoestring. They don't spend a lot of money on administrative costs. There's one organization right now that I'm looking at really carefully called I Emphasize, and I know he's in Mexico right now working with rescued sex slaves and escaped sex slaves, and these are kids. These are like 10 to 14-year-olds who are living in tents and lean-tos and things like that.
Wow.
So, and he's doing a lot with the lot lizards here to educate truckers. So he's one person who I think is really good. So I've on my blog, if you go to nancydeville.com and go to my blog, right in the upper right hand corner is what you can do if you're interested in helping sex slaves, and I've listed some organizations. Free the Slaves is a very important organization. Kevin Bales is the leading expert on human trafficking in the world today, and he has a plan to eradicate slavery in 25 years. So that's a very, very important organization to donate money to.
Wow. And I like your video too. You have one today on your blog, nancydeville.com blog. The title is Be Compassionate Toward Yourself. I really enjoyed taking that in before the show because it just gave me such a nice warm connection to you before we even began to talk. So, you're doing some terrific stuff, Nancy. There's no question that you're really, you know, shaking things up and helping to change the world for a better place.
Thank you, Lance. I really appreciate hearing that, and the feeling is mutual.
Oh, thank you, too. You know, what's funny, I've often talked to people I know in private, and it's amazing how many people have been abused and raped and as children.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a great deal of shame and insecurity and
mm-hmm.
Unprocessed feelings. Well, my guest last week was one who had been sold by her parents to the cult as a little girl, and she was used as a sex object
mm-hmm.
by her parents and by the cult for years.
My God.
Mm-hmm. So it took her 30 years just to reach a point where she had a near-death experience and then was able to start moving through that and come back into her body.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fascinating story, and I thought, gee, this is, you know, this is probably pretty prevalent that people have these experiences, and it's important for anybody who has had an experience like this to not blame themselves
mm-hmm.
and to try not to feel guilt. Or anger. I mean, I suppose you have to work through that anger, but it's something that happens to a lot of people, and it's nothing to be ashamed of.
Well, one of the things I do talk about on my Facebook page, and I do regular videos on, is metta meditation, because loving kindness meditation has been proven in through MRI studies to
mm-hmm.
shrink. In 8 weeks, 45 minutes a day of metta meditation shrinks the amygdala, and that's the part of your brain that registers fear, panic, anxiety, and those kinds of feelings. It's like it's the fight or flight part of your brain.
Uh-huh.
And then it actually increases the size of the insula, which is the part of your brain that makes you warm and fuzzy and has compassionate feelings. So it makes that bigger and makes the other part smaller. We're talking incrementally, of course, but
right.
But to the point where if you can experience that in 8 weeks, and I know that my own calming down in my lifetime has been, I can attribute that directly to metta meditation. It really, really works, and it's free. That's the nice thing about it. you know, so.
Well, now, where can people find that? We're just about out of time, so I want to make sure that everybody gets to find out where your websites are and your Facebook account and so on.
Just go to nancydeville.com, and you can go directly to my fan page where my videos are and directly to my blog.
Wonderful. Well, Nancy, you've got a blockbuster of a book there. I can't thank you enough for writing such a gripping novel that has so much meat to it. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences with us. And it's been a delight to talk to you. And I wish you the best.
Thank you, Lance. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I'm
all
Shanti.
Right. Maybe we'll do another show on health foods someday.
Oh, fabulous.
I'd love to have you back again. All right. Good luck on your book.
Okay. Good night.
All right. Good night, everybody.